Asante sana ya Colombia.
It's the music of Zanzibar, which would later merge with Tanganyika to become Tanzania. It helped to give voice to the voiceless, registering their dissatisfaction with colonialism and injustice. How does music help us understand Tanzania's history and its transformation? What makes Tanzania unique among nations? I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
Although we may know that Tanzania is the country of Mount Kilimanjaro, Africa's tallest mountain, or that it contains the famous Serengeti National Park filled with wild animals, most of us know far too little about the complicated history, rich artistic culture, and modern struggles of this African nation. Joining us to explore Tanzania is Emily Kalachi, a professor of history at UW-Madison who specializes in Eastern Africa.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thanks so much for having me.
The music that we started with almost, at least to me, points out the intriguing thing about Tanzania is it sounds African to some extent. It also sounds Arabic to some extent. And you've had more than, I think, a lot of parts of Africa, this real cultural convergence in Tanzania.
Mm-hmm. Yes, so that song by Siti Bitinsad was from the island of Zanzibar, which is an island off the coast of Tanzania, which is now part of Tanzania. But one of the distinctive things about the cultural history of that region is that it's really been a kind of crossroads that kind of connected these networks of exchange, both of culture and trade and religion, with the interior of the continent, but also throughout the Indian Ocean world. So Taarab music in particular, the kind of music we're just listening to, is it has its roots in a kind of court music played for the sultans of Oman, who were later imperial rulers in Zanzibar, and then later became popularized by singers like Siti throughout the streets of Zanzibar during the era of colonial rule, and became a real kind of popularized music, sung as that song was in Swahili rather than Arabic, and so became a really kind of popular art form.
Before we get into some of the background with Tanzania and its history, the colonial past and all that, what led you to specialize in this particular country, this region, Tanzania?
Yeah, well, you know, it wasn't a particularly straightforward kind of journey. You know, I actually began school as a music major without any particular interest in Africa. And it was just kind of by coincidence that I took a class in African history in my first year and then kind of changed course. But I think early on, I studied abroad in Kenya as an undergraduate. And, you know, that was when I really kind of had my interest sparked. You know, I was there during a really kind of interesting time politically. It was right before an election was happening. And I had a really, really great experience there that really kind of hooked me into it. So
you should probably give us some kind of a summary of the epochs of Tanzania, because it has had all these waves of influence. I mean, not that many parts of Africa have had, for example, a German colonization period.
Yeah.
And even just the basic geography.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, so Tanzania is on the east coast of Africa, on the Indian Ocean coast. It's right around just south of the equator. And, you know, one of the tricky things about talking about the different kinds of epochs in Tanzania's history is that, of course, it's only been a modern nation state for a few decades. And before that, of course, it was a colony. So to trace the history back much further, you know, you're getting into a time when the boundaries of what we now call Tanzania, you know, don't make much sense historically.
Sure.
But of course, the Swahili coast, for example, if you take that region as a kind of basis of telling a story, you can really go back many, many centuries, both to the kinds of migrations of Africans across the continent, to the coastal areas, to, you know, the first arrivals of sailors and traders on the coast of East Africa in the 8th century. So there's really a very, very long history there.
When reading a little bit about Zanzibar, I come to the conclusion that if there's an island there, people are going to find it sooner rather than later. I mean, Zanzibar is a little ways off the coast,
mm-hmm.
and yet it's been apparently occupied for 20,000 years.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. It's been a really kind of important site of connecting the trade links, you know, through the Indian Ocean world and then to the African continent. So.
And the attraction of Zanzibar, was it mostly spices for much of its history?
Yeah, you know, it's been the site of a few different kinds of particularly important trade items, cloves and spices being one. Of course, the other more infamous one is also the slave trade. Zanzibar was one of the major sites, you know, of the slave trade that kind of was a distribution point up into the Persian Gulf world.
I noticed on the BBC sort of chronology of Tanzania, they start with 1498 when the Portuguese explorer Vasco da Gama visits the Tanzania coast. Anything we should know before the arrival of the Portuguese in terms of what the Portuguese found when they got there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's kind of funny. That's obviously a very Eurocentric
yes.
kind of portrayal of when the history started.
That's what it is.
When the Europeans discovered it. Yeah. Let's see. So in terms of the history of East Africa, you mean when we mm-hmm. could start? Gosh, you know, we could go back so many centuries. You know, my colleague, who I think has been on the show before, actually, Neil Kodesh, teaches pre-colonial mm-hmm. African history. And you really, you know, can go back using things like archaeology and historical linguistics many centuries before that. So yes, at the time when the Portuguese arrived, you know, you already had a really thriving kind of cosmopolitan urban culture along the coast of East Africa, particularly in these Swahili city-states along the coast, where you have traders from the region developing these really strong linkages both up and down the coast. You know, there's a small kind of boat made locally called the dhow. So you talk about the dhow trade, you're talking about these local kind of networks that both went inland on these river systems, you know, connecting trade with the interior communities, and then up and down the coastal areas as well. And then beyond that, of course, you have a larger kind of trade that was largely dictated by the monsoon winds. So you had monsoon winds that would take traders in one direction across the Indian Ocean one time of year, and then back the other direction another time of year, connecting it with the Gujarat and West India, and then, of course, Oman and other parts of the Indian Ocean world.
And what did the Portuguese do with that part of Africa? We'll call it Tanzania, mm-hmm. Once they had it.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm not sure the Portuguese ever really had it in the sense we typically think of colonial rule. And one of the so the Portuguese you know, conquest was largely a violent one, you know, attempting to kind of control trade routes. So earlier on, the Portuguese had been settling along the coast and establishing trade relationships, particularly trying to get to the gold trade networks that went into the interior of the continent. I don't know if you've heard of Great Zimbabwe, this ancient city in what's now Zimbabwe, but there's a gold trade that extended, you know, into that part of the continent that, you know, the Portuguese were largely interested in having some control over. And part of, you know, what happened later on when the Portuguese were ousted from East Africa was that, you know, the Omani Sultanate, you know, based in Oman, you know, you have local communities on the coast of what's now Kenya trying to get them to come and help them to oust the Portuguese. And so that's, you know, so making that kind of alliance allowed them to oust the Portuguese. But then, of course, they had this new kind of colonial relationship with the Omani Sultanate.
Which I gather was much longer and more invasive, you might say, or more effective, had a greater influence on that part of Africa.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was around for longer, as you point out, certainly. And it was a very different style. You know, there was a real interest in making alliances with local kinds of, you know, political communities and, you know, trying to rule effectively more through that rather than a kind of style of conquest.
It worked for the British for centuries.
Mm, yeah, certainly similarities.
So when did the Germans come in?
In the late 19th century.
So up until that time, you've got the Omani Arab culture pretty much?
Well, so the Omani imperialism was, you know, in Zanzibar off the coast and then in the coast of Kenya. So German conquest does not go to the north in Kenya. It's basically what is today Tanzania. Another very violent kind of a conquest pattern there as well, in terms of, you know, lots of kind of, you know, pursuit of scorched earth campaigns and a really kind of brutal policy of repression. And of course, lots of resistance and happening as well.
So the Germans, we think of being, if nothing else, at least very organized and very structured in their approach to things. Did they colonize in the more conventional sense once they got to what is now Tanzania? Or were they just kind of like passing through, taking what they could get and passing that along?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Also, so one of the kinds of stories we tell about German colonialism has to do with the process of actually trying to kind of make alliances with local chiefdoms, right? Because, you know, there are all different kinds of political systems already in existence, you know, in East Africa when the Germans arrive. You know, you have large, you know, organized kingdoms and empires, you know, African empires. You also have, you know, kind of scattered, mobile, stateless societies. And the ways that the Germans attempted to kind of establish rule was very much, what they thought they were accomplishing was very different than what I think, well, what for sure local communities believed them to be accomplishing. So, for example, you'll have all these stories about, you know, German colonizers going on behalf of the German government, have, you know, signing treaties with these local, you know, community leaders who may or may not actually have been legitimate local community
right,
leaders. You know,
I've heard that one before.
Yeah, exactly. So it's really a very uneven the way it happened on the ground. And of course, you have lots of very powerful local politicians also kind of playing that relationship as well, trying to make a kind of relationship with this new kind of, you know, power in the region, this new kind of source of perhaps resources or guns or that kind of thing. Also kind of using that to their advantage in their own kinds of political, you know, conflicts and you know, competitions that were happening locally.
So are there, I realize we wouldn't have a lot of time for this to happen given the way history accelerated during the 20th century, but did the Germans make an effort to build cities, to bring in colonists, farmers, miners, industrialists?
I mean, there's a little bit of, you know, things like urban planning and that kind of thing, but much of that kind of, you know, really intense on-the-ground occupation of you know, colonies happened much more after World War II. So the earlier time period was much less intensive in that sense of actually building infrastructure and that kind of thing. And one of the other things about that I think really dictated a lot of how German colonial rule would happen in East Africa was that there's a massive and very organized and effective uprising called the Maji Maji Rebellion in the, you know, first few years of the 20th century that really, you know, was quite effective at kind of targeting sites of German colonial power. And it was very much, you know, a kind of, it spread very quickly and very, you know, across very large, across the territory, you know, without any kind of centralized organization. And of course, the response to that was a very kind of, you know, repressive, again, as I mentioned before, scorched earth kind of policy.
Yes, we're kind of familiar with that sort of technique.
And if you are in Tanzania today, what sort of remnants do you see that would tell you, or vestiges that would tell you of this Portuguese past, the German past, and then later the British? I mean, if you just sort of look around a given city, like Dar es Salaam or something, do you see evidence that all those forces were there?
You do. I mean, there are a few places where you see that kind of history. And one, for example, is the Swahili language itself. You know, Swahili is a Bantu language. You know, all of its grammatical structures and the vast majority of its vocabulary, you know, reflect its Bantu origins. But, for example, you have some words from Portuguese, like mesa, the word for table, you know, comes from Portuguese. you have lots of Arabic, you know, words in Swahili as well. So that kind of, you know, that kind of cosmopolitanism really has, you know, shaped the language.
What about religions, architecture, you know, those sorts of things? Do you find a fusion of different influences?
Definitely, yes. A lot of the cities, particularly the older cities, you can see lots of different kinds of, you know, influences in the architecture. You see, particularly places like Zanzibar, you know, you see, you know, old colonial buildings, but also you see lots of the buildings of Omani elites. You see the kinds of houses of Gujarati traders that have, you know, kinds of, you know, architecture and carving that comes from West India. And then from later, of course, you have, you know, British colonial structures that are still around, perhaps have been repurposed for other kinds of uses. So it's really very apparent in the landscape as well, I think.
Was it losing World War I that caused the Germans to relinquish their grasp on Tanzania?
Yep. So after World War I, it became a protectorate of the British.
Always a fascinating word, but a lot of that part of the world fell under the protectorate. I mean, some of the, I remember right, some of the Arabian Peninsula was also British protectorate, and in the Middle East, other places too. And was that fairly benign, that experience?
World War One.
Well, that was a very friendly,
I meant in East
very
Africa,
friendly
but...
get-together. No, I mean, the British experience in Tanzania, because when you say protectorate, that does make it sound a little bit more hands-off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think that it being called a protectorate. Yeah, I think that might obscure
that
some. I would say yes. That might obscure some of the violence and inherent to the colonial enterprise. There certainly there were the kinds of violence, both in overt kinds of ways, in terms of actual physical brutality, a kind of in terms of policing and prison systems, that kind of thing. But also in more kind of less overt kinds of ways as well.
Who was the nominal head of the government in Tanzania at that time, or Tanganyika and Zanzibar? Who was ostensibly running the place? I mean,
at what time?
Head of state during the protectorate.
Well, there it really kind of depended. One of the interesting things about colonial rule, particularly to use the term that the British used, you have this idea of indirect rule, which is the idea, and again, this is very much an idea that you're ruling through local populations.
Right.
So, for example, the category of chief. So, one of the things that's interesting about one of the assumptions that colonial powers had in Africa was that Africa was organized into tribes, and that all Africans lived in tribes, and that was the unit of life that could kind of uniformly be assumed to exist in Africa. And, part of that assumption was that Africans all, lived under the authority of a chief, and they all, obeyed that chief and respected that chief's authority. Now, this is largely a fantasy. This is not the kind of, there are not only very many kinds of political systems, but also a very, sophisticated ways of actually constituting political authority and contesting political authority. So this idea about the authoritarian chief, ruling over a tribe was very much a fiction. But it's a fiction that became the form of government, de jure of the British colonial era in much of Africa, including in Tanzania. So you have these chiefs who may or may not have had authority, before colonial rule, who become the kind of figure of colonial authority, under the idea that they are ruling in this kind of traditional way over traditional peoples, when in fact their authority comes from this kind of position, with respect to the colonial state.
And the resources, I presume, which everybody, all the colonial powers are after in the first place, I assume they're pretty much just leeching out of the country straight into the hands of the colonials, or are the indigenous people getting any benefit from them?
Well, I think so much of the colonial infrastructure was based on the idea of an extractive economy. That said, though, many innovative and organized communities of producers also used some of the benefits of having, for example, a railroad system or connectivity to actually advance their own interests. So one of the big examples in Tanzania would be coffee farmers during this era when you have, and I should mention there are many laws in place, both in Kenya and Tanzania, actually, that try to restrict the abilities of Africans to grow their own coffee, to control the marketing of that coffee, and to organize politically around their access to that crop. There's really kind of an effort to kind of, get it basically out of the continent and to pay farmers as little as possible. A familiar story, I'm
yes,
sure.
Yes.
But at the same time, you have these really, these really organized, longstanding political communities, particularly in the Kilimanjaro region, to give a particularly famous example of farmers who really made intensive investments in agriculture and really built a very strong export economy based on coffee during that time period as well. And they became a major kind of political force during the eras of decolonization as well.
And what point did the slave trade end?
That's a great question. When it ends legally, when it ends on the ground, when it ends according to who is very, really depends on who you ask. And, I guess that the short answer is that it ended very slowly over time. But one of the so you have, particularly in the case of East Africa, where we're talking about the Arabian slave trade rather than the Atlantic world slave trade, is that you have abolition declared, but then the abolition actually is of the slave trade and not of slavery itself. So one of the consequences of the legal banning of the slave trade is that you have this surplus of slaves that actually leads to the creation of a plantation economy, a plantation slave economy in East Africa that intensifies the practice of slavery locally.
So you're talking about slavery, slaves being held within
exactly.
Tanzania rather than exported. I'm curious about if you go into high school or college in Tanzania today, and you look at history books, how is the slave trade presented, and are some of the subtleties you're talking about the way that the British sort of created this fiction of the chiefs, and how is the teaching of history handled in Tanzania, and where do they sort of point to their George Washington figure?
Yeah, that's a really, really great question. I'm always really interested whenever I travel to Tanzania to go to the university and a lot of my colleagues in the history department there, I love talking about this kind of stuff with them. So one of the really University of Dar es Salaam, although it's come down on some really difficult times financially, has historically been a really, really important university in East Africa. A lot of really prominent intellectuals studied there. And one of the kind of central programs they were known for was their history program. And so, you know, there's this great program there where that really emphasized social history, kind of recovering a history of the people, you know, because so many people who grew up in the colonial era were educated, you know, largely being taught the history of Europeans in Africa. And larger, you know, a lot of them, you know, learned about, of course, British history and not so much about African history. You know, there's this long, you know, standing idea that Africans didn't have a history, that history began, you know, when Europeans arrived.
Right, just like the BBC chronology.
Exactly, like the BBC chronology. Exactly, yeah. So there has been this great effort largely since the 60s and you know, continuing to this day of sending university students out to the places they come from to interview their elders and to collect oral histories and to write theses and books based on these kind of more local kinds of histories. So that's still very much a part of the culture, I think, of the University of Dar es Salaam is that kind of social history that really tries to reclaim a history that comes from a kind of more local source.
How was the University of Dar es Salaam founded, and what's the official language of the university?
You know, I'm not sure if they have an official language, although I know that there's a lot of debate about that. Many of their classes are taught in Swahili and others taught in English. So I'm not sure if there's an official policy on that, but both are taught. Now, let's see, the history of the university. I know that it was founded in the colonial era, but at some point it turned hands and, you know, became, you know, a Tanzanian institution, but I'm not entirely sure how that process happened.
Because it's always an interesting question as to, well, okay, founding this university, which is, of course, where people come together with various ideas. Mm-hmm. Some of those ideas are inevitably going to be anti-colonial.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. The university actually was a real hotbed for you know, political luminaries, particularly in the 1960s. And so one of the things really distinctive about Tanzania in the 60s and in the early 70s is that Nyerere, you know, the first president of Tanzania, Julius Nyerere, he was very interested in the kind of ideal of Pan-Africanism and really kind of making Tanzania a home for African intellectuals from around the continent. And particularly so, Tanzania, you know, is independent in 1961, but you still have many countries in southern Africa that are still under, you know, colonial rule, particularly the former Portuguese colonies, you know, Angola and Mozambique.
Changing very quickly in the 60s, yes.
Yeah, and then, of course, you know, this apartheid, you know, South Africa was still under apartheid at that time. So Dar es Salaam becomes a real kind of home for lots of exiled politicians and political activists and thinkers during that time, and many of them make their home at the University of Dar es Salaam, as well as, you know, in the city itself. So it becomes a real kind of hotbed of political activity at that time. Lots of kind of anti-imperial thinkers, lots of Marxist thinkers making their home at the university at that time. And on the one hand, that really kind of would seem to resonate with the kind of political program that Tanzania, which, you know, became a socialist country, you know, was promoting. At the same time, though, many of these thinkers really were willing to take some of these radical politics further than the government was willing to take them, you know.
Sure.
And so they became a point of tension between the ruling party and these kinds of expat intellectuals who were really kind of promoting these more radical kinds of international messages.
We'll look further at the repercussions of independence for Tanzania and the way the country emerged in the 60s and into the 70s when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Emily Colacci, and we are talking about Tanzania. One of the things we haven't mentioned as we're talking about the sort of colonial history and we're getting close to the movement toward independence is the role that women played, both back in Tanzania's past, where, you know, did they have some of the sort of matriarchal communities like some other African countries, or were the women often under colonial rule or just in general in fairly traditional roles?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I would say that overall, colonial rule was not very good for most women. I don't know. I think in general we can say that colonial systems, for example, tended to, for example, favor men in educational systems and that kind of thing. And so when we first started the show, there I brought in a clip of a song by a singer you mentioned named Siti Binti Saad. It was called Wewe Paka is the name of the song. It means you are a cat. And so this is a song, I think, it's a really great kind of example of some of the kinds of burdens that women living in the colonial system really faced. On the one hand, you have the burden of being an African woman who has to live under a system of rule that is racially repressive. It denies rights to Africans, to the resources of government, to you know, all kinds of freedoms that one, you know, would have in a system that's more representative. And at the same time, they're also dealing with the kinds of, you know, kinds of oppression of gender at the same time. So this is a song in this tradition of Taarab that I mentioned. And one of the things that's distinctive about Taarab when it becomes popularized, when it goes from being a kind of a court sort of music that's played for Sultan and the Sultan's kinds of entourage, when it goes from that kind of formal setting out into the streets, it becomes a real kind of message and a tool of social critique for people who performed it. So one of the things that Siti was really known for is for writing these songs that really spoke to some of the kinds of complaints and injustices that people experienced under colonial rule. And so this song, Wewe Paka, is a song about the sexual harassment of women in the streets at the time.
So I am a cat, as in having to be sneaky, having to... Why a cat?
Well, so at first, she is the first stanza, you know, goes, you're a cat, why do you harass me? Cat, why are you harassing all the neighbors? You'll be beaten, you should be made to pay, you should be made to pay for this. So she's actually calling her sexual harasser a cat.
Okay, and she's the mouser.
Exactly, okay. Yeah.
So the predator. Exactly,
yeah. So those kinds of songs. And the kind of songs, too, oftentimes these Taarab songs were kind of sneaky in that they could make some kind of social critique, you know, of, for example, the sexual harassment of women, of things like poverty. There are other songs, for example, that critique the colonial court system for not giving justice to people who lived in the poor neighborhoods, those kinds of things. But oftentimes the songs would have kind of double meanings, or they would be kind of obscure in the ways that they made their critique so that they couldn't really be, you know, couldn't be caught kind of saying something that was, for example, anti-government or mm-hmm. anti, you know, people in positions of power. So they had this kind of
subtext.
Poetic language. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. So this is You Are a Cat with Siti Binti Saad from Zanzibar.
Confluence of cultures, to be sure. And is this the sort of thing, then, that would have played on Dar es Salaam radio a few decades ago? Or, you know, is this typical of its time?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so Siti is one of the real popular ones, you know, and she's one of the first people to actually be recorded on record. She traveled to Bombay during her life to actually make a recording that became very popular. So one of the things you'll notice is that the sound of that music, you can tell that it's influenced by lots of different kinds of musical traditions. You know, you have the traditions of Arabic court music as well as other influences. So that was one of the things that was really kind of part of how people thought about social status, particularly, you know, at this time in the 1920s and 30s, you know, in places like Zanzibar and the coast, like Dar es Salaam. To be associated with this kind of cosmopolitan Indian Ocean world culture was a sign of status and also, you know, one's kinds of social resources. So, for example, you have all these social clubs in Dar es Salaam, you know, forming in the interwar years and beyond that were organized around Taarab music concerts. And the bands would have names like, I mean, the songs would all be in Swahili. They would have very kind of messages that are very much based on life in a particular neighborhood or a particular kind of social setting, but they would have a name like Egyptian, you know, social club or Egyptian, you know, like band or that kind of thing, really kind of referencing this kind of cosmopolitan knowledge that the people who are singing this music and participating, you know, like to think of themselves as having. So you had that real kind of cosmopolitan.
Once you get into independence and you have this country that has fairly artificial boundaries that were carved, you know, in more or less straight lines by the British and before them, I presume, other colonial powers. Once you're an independent country, you need a kind of a central culture, which is something the United States has been struggling with for a couple of centuries now. How has Tanzania focused its culture in those last 50 years or so of independence?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It's been a really I think a really tricky one for a lot of the first generation of African nationalist intellectuals and politicians and culture makers. And it so happens, actually, I brought in a passage I thought really spoke to this topic. It's made in the inauguration speech that Julius Nyerere made when he became president in 1962. And it's about this issue of culture. I mean, this is part of his speech. He said, "When we were at school, we were taught to sing the songs of the Europeans. But how many of us were taught the songs of the Wanyamwezi or of the Wahehe?" These are, you know, ethnic groups in Tanzania. He goes on, "Many of us have learnt to dance the rumba or the cha-cha-cha, to rock and roll and to twist and to even dance the waltz and the foxtrot. But how many of us can dance or have even heard of the Gombe Sugu, the Konge, the Nyangumumi, Kiduo, or Lele Mama?" Now, these are all, you know, different dances, you know, of Tanzanian peoples. And then, you know, he ends by saying, "It's hard for any man to get much real excitement from dances and music which are not in his own blood." And so he goes on then to propose to kind of form this Ministry of National Culture that will go around the country and seek to kind of bring together the different kinds of traditions of different regions and make them into kind of a single national culture.
Do they have a national hero?
Do Tanzanians have a national hero? Like mythic, you know, ancient figures?
Yeah, again, a unifying figure. It could be even a historical figure for that matter.
Yeah, well, there are many. I mean, you have, for example, Julius Nyerere himself is someone who's remembered with a great deal of nostalgia and fondness. You know, you have also earlier generations of warrior kings, very successful kind of military, you know, leaderships. Like, for example, you have Chief Mirambo from Western Tanzania, the Unyamwezi Kingdom. You know, he's remembered for his great military strength and, you know, having created this big kind of empire. So those kinds of heroes, I think. You know, and as I mentioned, this is a real kind of effort for people to kind of gather these local histories at the end of independence from colonial rule.
It seems to me you could take that speech that he gave and apply it to the Aborigines in Australia. You could apply it to the Native Americans here, that feeling of needing to reclaim one's own identity when it's been, you know, especially when you've had it sort of taken away from you that way, to try to reclaim it, which is tricky sometimes. And besides going around trying to record stories from elders, you know, trying to get sort of the historical truth before it was gone, how successful were they at creating a sort of national culture?
Yeah, well, you know, I think that while one can, of course, really understand the importance of you know, creating a national culture and doing away with very Eurocentric ways of understanding one's history, at the same time, I think the kind of vision that one can create a monolithic, you know, singular national culture also has many exclusions involved. And the question of who gets to determine what is an authentically African culture, what is a national culture, that's really a question of power that, of course, can be used in lots of different ways. ways. So, for example, we have this longer history of Swahili urbanism, just, you know, because it's the part of the country I study on the coast, that really is involves, you know, it includes, peoples and cultures and practices, you know, from the West Indian Ocean, from, you know, the Islamic world. And while this is considered this real kind of part of a kind of cosmopolitan African modernity up until a certain point, with independence, when you're now claiming that this is, you know, all foreign, now we have to really, you know, define African culture in this much more kind of, in many ways, limited way. That leads to all different kinds of exclusions and, in some cases, violence.
How did the government work once independence kicked in for Tanzania? What kind of government in theory and what kind in practice?
Mm-hmm. So in the case of Tanzania, there's a real kind of important turning point in 1967. So independence happens in 1961, and you have this effort to build, you know, a local democratic government. But in 1967, you have Nyerere produces this document called the Arusha Declaration, which essentially sets into motion a project of African socialism. It lays out an agenda for a socialist economy and a socialist program that organizes the country along socialistic lines. And what's distinctive about this in the Tanzanian case is that what Nyerere was trying to do, in part, was to kind of unite, on the one hand, the idea of a kind of modernizing socialist economy that would really, you know, modernize agricultural production and basically raise the standard of living of Tanzanians. At the same time, though, unlike the way this was, approached in other parts of the world, he was very determined that this would be an authentically African traditional form of socialism that would be based on African traditions of community living and African ways of life. So this is part of, you know, what he's trying to do, at least in terms of ideology. And the central kind of program in that larger sort of political philosophy is a practice of villagization, trying to organize the entire country into these village units.
And now what kind of pressures from within and without for Tanzania at this point?
You mean in terms of its socialistic kind of leanings?
Yes, and national security.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Tanzania was part of a larger network of countries in the global south that were part of the non-aligned movement, trying to have this kind of south-south kind of, you know, alliances based on ideas about socialism that didn't participate in what was, you know, what the global war kinds of positionings of other major world powers at that time. So there are those kinds of connections going on. One of the major kind of, you know, some of the major relationships that Tanzania had was both with China, but also with other African countries that were on similar kinds of paths.
I noticed in this Arusha Declaration that you were mentioning from 1967, he says, it is stupid to rely on money as the major instrument of development when we know only too well that our country is poor. Mm-hmm. And he also talks about it being stupid to rely on industries. So besides emphasizing agriculture and growing food, presumably, and sort of how much progress has been made in terms of poverty in Tanzania?
Mm-hmm.
From the time this was written in 1967 to now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, and you have to address then the resources, too. I mean, I gather you mentioned agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
I gather there's a fair, because I believe in that same statement, he refers to arable land that they have. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not a poor country in that sense. And they have gold. They have other resources that are, you know, valuable on the world market. Have they been able to distribute the wealth from those in a socialistic way?
Mm-hmm. Well, so Tanzania remains a very poor country, one of the poorest countries in the world. And, you know, there's some debate among scholars in different fields, you know, in economics and political science and history about the impact of African socialism, which I should mention, you know, it came to a formal end in 1985. But the question of whether that the kinds of economic failings of socialism in terms of, you know, failing to raise the standard of living of Tanzanians, and in fact, you know, by many measures, standard of living really fell during that time period. But something that I think it's important to consider is the kind of situation that Nyerere was dealing with. You know, how much was he actually able to control based on factors in his control and factors outside of his control? So, for example, one of the factors that really kind of rocked the Tanzanian economy in 1970s was, you know, the oil shocks of 1973. So you can imagine at a time when, you know, the two kind of major, you know, economic factors here are that you have the price of tropical goods, you know, the things that are exported, you know, like palm oil and cloves and coffee. The prices for those drop dramatically at the same time as the price of oil goes really, really high. So for a country that's trying to actually industrialize for the first time, you know, to have the oil prices go up so high and become scarce is really, really very devastating.
So they don't have oil to speak. They do later, I guess, or much more recently, find natural gas off the coast.
That's going to be very interesting to see how that unfolds. Yes, but there's that, and then also there is, you know, obviously how I don't want to let Nuri off the hook here, but the way that the way that vigilance was actually practiced on the ground was really very. What happened in practice is often very different than what happened in theory in terms of, you know, and it was very different in different parts of the country. You do have certain areas that really tried to embrace this kind of villagization, you know, at a very grassroots level. And you have other areas where it was, you know, you had basically a very top-down, you know, forcing people to move into villages without providing for the kinds of resources that would allow that transition to happen smoothly. So you have people moving, you know, having to move, you know, from where their family had farmed for generations without being given something, you know, of equivalent productivity, you know, and have, how do you actually, you know, sustain your family?
That
in
kind
the
of
meantime.
Redistribution, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not exactly beloved by all. Do you have an urbanization effect also of people seeking a higher standard of living in Dar es Salaam and Zanzibar City?
Yeah, so this is one of the interesting things I think about this time period is that, you know, so, you know, this is a strand you see in lots of, you know, post-colonial kinds of political cultures, which is particularly pronounced in Tanzania, is this kind of anti-urban sentiment. The idea that, I guess at a cultural level, that urban living is associated with a kind of colonial culture and that, you know, the rural countryside is associated with a kind of more, you know, authentically African style of living. But then economically,
English would say much the same thing 200 years ago.
Yeah. But then in terms of economic development, the idea is that the economy is going to develop in the countryside. And so there's a real effort to ban people from moving to cities. You know, during this time, you have, for example, lots of people fleeing to the cities, basically, because of things like rural poverty, because of the kinds of problems of villagization, because of drought and famine and this kind of thing. So cities actually, you know, kind of paradoxically are really, really growing at the same time as New Areas promoting this idea
of
rural socialism.
What about education, though? I mean, he says that, you know, money is not our future, but if they have a reasonable number of resources, education, and if you just want to call it flat out job training too, on top of that would seem to be the future.
Mm-hmm. One of the major accomplishments of Nyerere's regime, and I think this is universally recognized, is the raising literacy rates. And this kind of campaign known as the Adult Education Revolution, and I think it started in 1972, there was this real effort to teach literacy not just to children in elementary schools, but also actually make adults literate through these community centers. So you have all kinds of young, you know, basically youth who are part of the ruling party kind of patronage networks who are sent out to the countryside to teach literacy, Swahili literacy, in these community centers. And so by some estimates, literacy rates, you know, rose from something around 10% of the population at independence to somewhere around 60-70, you know,
quite a growth. Yeah.
So there's a real great effort to promote that kind of grassroots education.
We're going to talk about popular culture and modern Tanzania when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
That's a Tanzanian group called Nuta Jazz. And if you were with us at the beginning of this hour, you detected probably quite a contrast between that piece of music and the one we started with, which comes from not that many years prior. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Emily Kalachi, who is telling us about the culture now of Tanzania, particularly in the years from independence in 1961 till about 1985 or so, this period of socialism in Tanzania in particular. What cultural phenomena were able to thrive under socialism in Tanzania? Things obviously have changed quite a bit by the sound of this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So one of the things that was kind of what are the effects of social? So there was a kind of a controlled economy that kind of limited the kinds of exports that would come over the border. And in many ways, this kind of restricted the ability of musicians, for example, to access things like musical instruments, to travel abroad. At the same time, though, it made a really vibrant kind of local scene. Without things like television, without things like or when things like imported records were difficult to come by, you have, you know, young musicians really in many ways like becoming the center of social life. So going out to dance halls and nightclubs was one of the central places a young person would spend their time in Dar es Salaam in the socialist period. And this music kind of exemplifies some of the sound of that as well.
What do we hear? What do you hear in it that sort of is uniquely Tanzanian?
Well, so one of the things, and you'd have to, you know Swahili to pick this out, but this song is called, Mpenzi Nina Kukanya, or Lover, I'm Warning You. And so this is a song, is written by a man who, this is a small social club, in a part of Dar es Salaam. And typically, the people who would come to this social club, you know, they all knew each other. They'd come every week. And the musicians, you know, knew the people in the audience. And so oftentimes, they would write songs about some of the, you know, gossipy things that were happening among their friends. So this song, Lover, I'm Warning You, the man who wrote this song was writing about one of his friends whose wife was a bit of a gossip. And so he was writing this song to kind of basically shame her and say, stop talking about family business out in the streets, you know, because it's really starting to, you know, make your family look bad. So, like, this is the kind of, like, you know, this is something that I think this kind of tradition of, you know, making kind of moral commentary with music and this kind of public performance can go back, you know, centuries in Swahili poetry traditions and even in taarab music as well. So that aspect of the song is actually in many ways quite similar to the Wewe Paka song we heard earlier.
With the rise of literacy in Tanzania in the 60s and 70s and into the 80s, do you have then a burgeoning market for writers and people buying books?
You know, there is actually, and it's kind of an interesting story. So, you know, one of the major endeavors of the colonial cultural ministries at this time is to produce a kind of national literature. So you have a department at the University of Dar es Salaam that's really promoting standardizing Swahili and creating textbooks and novels and stuff to distribute to the population. At the same time, though, you have this kind of underground literature developing at the same time along much more kind of popular cultural kind of themes. You know, what I'm referring to here is what people at the time who disapproved of this called briefcase publishers. They're these young men who migrated to the city who had grown up, you know, with things like James Bond movies and detective thrillers and romance stories. And they wrote Swahili versions of these. And they published them, you know, basically illegally on the black market and in Swahili and then distributed them throughout the city and sold them.
Oh, it was illegally because these were private enterprises in a socialist state?
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. So these were published.
I wasn't objecting to the content, just the fact that they were private enterprise.
Yeah, I mean that was the major kind of objection. Although oftentimes, though, many of the themes covered could, you know, were very critical of some of the political elites at the time as well. So in that sense, they were in many ways kind of a political threat as well, particularly in terms of generational politics. You know, the heroes in all of these stories are these young Tanzanian men. Oftentimes, they'll be like, you know, they'll put themselves or they'll put the main character as a kind of James Bond kind of detective figure, or later on as a kung fu fighter. But the person they're fighting is often, for example, a corrupt politician or a diamond, you know, magnate or some kind of, powerful government person. So in that way, there's a kind of hidden social critique in many of these novellas as well, which makes them kind of political as well as entertaining.
What do you see as the biggest misconceptions that people have about Tanzania?
Do you mean in an American context?
Yeah. Or just in general. Let's say you meet someone on the plane and they ask you what you do and you talk about how you work on the study of Tanzania.
Or do they know enough even to have misconceptions?
Yeah, you know, I think that I think it's really shaped around ideas of Africa as a place of problems, of a place of conflict and of need. I think that we're often taught to see Africa in terms of our role as, for example, you know, a philanthropist or as a kind of former colonizer or as a place that needs, you know, our help. And I think, you know, to see it in that way, you know, it comes from the right place. It comes from a kind of place of charity and sincerity. But I think it also in many ways reflects a longer kind of perhaps condescension in a way, that Tanzania is seen particularly as a place of problems rather than as a place that also, you know, has, for example, very long and strong political traditions, or as a place that has, you know, very, very strong and long, you know, cultural traditions. So I think that a lot of the misconceptions have to do with kind of taking, you know, something we might hear in the news, for example, about poverty or about maternal health, you know, problems,
HIV
and kind of projecting that. Exactly.
Yeah,
projecting that to be the single story that we tell about a place like that rather than one of many kinds of stories.
As the whole world globalizes, I mean, in this music that we started with from Nuta Jazz, I'm hearing right away all kinds of other kind of influences that I didn't hear in the earlier piece that we heard. Is there concern? Is there a phenomenon at all that now that things are becoming so globalized that Tanzania is losing those traditional roots, values, language, culture?
I think that, you know, artists in Tanzania, and if we're talking about popular culture anyway, have long, you know, drawn on, you know, cultural influences from other parts of the world and kind of incorporated them into their own kinds of expressive cultures and traditions. I mean, one of the things that I, you know, I tell my students is that globalization, you know, in Africa is not a new thing. I mean, it's, you know, Africa has been part of the world for a very, very long time. I mean, you know, you can see examples of it from, you know, centuries ago, you know. So I think that the idea that to, for example, incorporate what you might have heard in this last song, you know, Cuban, for example, musical influences.
Right, yes.
You know,
sounded like reggae.
Caribbean beat, yeah.
Yeah, the idea that that somehow makes it less African or dilutes, you know, one's culture, I think in many ways might be a misconception because, you know, these kinds of exchanges have gone on for so long. And, of course, if you want to take that history of Cuban music influencing Tanzanian music back another step, you can talk about the ways that Cuban music has in turn, in many ways, you know, has roots in African styles
of course,
of
music sure.
as well. Of
course, sure. Goes out and comes back, just like rock and roll, same thing. Has a lot of African roots, but then it comes back to Africa in a changed way.
Mm-hmm. I know your period of history kind of ends around 1985, but just take in our last minute or so, can you look ahead to the future of Tanzania? What are you watching the most carefully when you look at the news? What are you kind of looking to for the next year?
Yeah. Well, so one of the things actually that you mentioned a few minutes ago is the discovery of natural gas off the coast of Tanzania. That's something I'm watching with a lot of interest. You know, it'll be one of the things that's particularly, I think, interesting about this particular event is that, you know, it's obviously this very valuable natural resource, but it was discovered in off the coast of a very poor part of the country in southern Tanzania, a part of the country that's been very historically marginalized. And there's a lot of debate going on now about who should actually benefit from this resource, right?
Yeah,
should it,
exactly,
should it be
yeah.
piped back to the capital city, you know, where it can be controlled by ruling parties? Should people who live in the southern region benefit from this? And so this has been a really, you know, it sparked a lot of really interesting conversations, and I'll be watching that a lot.
But Tanzania, you think politically is on solid footing now?
You know, it's an interesting question. So Tanzania's basically had the same ruling party since independence. You know, they've only had multi-party elections, you know, within the past two decades. And there are multiple parties now, but there's still a kind of an issue of centralization in that way. And then, of course, there are also matters, you know, there's often tensions, for example, around election times about kind of breaking through that system a little bit. So yeah, I mean it's a place largely it's you know, you don't see a lot of open conflict or any of that kind of thing, but I think there are certainly tensions, you know, below the surface.
We'll see how they play out as all of these resources come into play and the world continues to shrink. Our guest has been Emily Kalache, a pleasant hour we've spent with you.
Thank you so much. This has been so much fun.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.